at the end of the day, our job is to ensure that the cleanup gets done. So if that means we compel the responsible party or the owner of the boat to do so, then that's what we'll do.
State and federal regulators act to clean up problem barges near Bethel. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, August 15th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a U.S. Special Representative for the Arctic talks priorities for the region.
I really need to open up the aperture and look a little more broadly at all the needs that are up here.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you've served in the military, the Alaska VA welcomes you home and thanks you for your service. We encourage you to enroll for VA health care benefits. Go to 1010ez.med.va.gov to apply online in less than 5 minutes, or print, fax, or mail the 2-page form to the VA. You do not need your DD-214 to apply. Call 257-3323 for questions. This message is sponsored by the VA.
State regulators are issuing dozens of trespass notices for old vessels sitting in the Kuskokwim River. Some of the barges and boats pose navigational and safety hazards, while others are just tied up on state land without a permit. Officials say it's the first step toward getting owners to take responsibility for vessels that are causing problems. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has more.
Barbara Anvil has a longtime fish camp right below where barges park in Steamboat Slough, just outside Bethel. She says besides getting in the way of people, the barges and other vessels are blocking fish.
We notice that our fish aren't coming up that slough anymore. We get less and less each year. We used to be able to put out our net and get a whole bunch of them.
Earlier this month, state officials and the U.S. Coast Guard met a packed house of Kuskokwim residents who wanted to get rid of the vessels that are piling up and causing problems. Emily Haynes with the Department of Natural Resources outlined basic concerns.
Number one, contaminants aboard, and that's kind of where we all play a factor. The navigability in Steamboat Slough, mostly.
DNR counted 20 vessels stored in Steamboat Slough during their visit, up 5 from last year. Historically, the slough has been a parking and storage spot for boats and barges, but as Bethel's grown, the number of vessels has increased. One high-profile barge named Shanks Ark has been stuck in the middle of the waterway for more than a year. The barge is owned by Bethel-based Kuskokwim Lighterage and Trucking and was being operated by Faulkner Walsh Constructors, according to DNR. The two companies disagree about who's responsible for removing it. Haynes says the first step toward getting the barge out of the way is issuing trespass notices for vessels in the slough.
It's not very widely known that we issue permits for barge storages or any vessel storage on state-owned lands, but that is something that we do. And now we're working towards gaining compliance from all of these vessel owners.
There hasn't been much enforcement until now, and the process takes time. Bob Carlson works in the Bethel Department of Environmental Conservation Office. He says DEC and DNR officials contacted Faulkner Walsh about another tugboat that grounded in Steamboat Slough in 2012, named the St. Michael, which was leaking fuel. He says he followed protocol and wrote the company a letter asking for action, but they did not respond. It took another year to get a DEC notice of violation issued.
They removed some of the contamination this spring. They removed the engines and some of the contamination. Some still remains in the boat we were up there yesterday. So the next step would be, in my agency, is a referral for enforcement, which would mean the Department of Law, we would ask the Department of Law to take criminal or civil action against the company.
Martin Andrew is president for the tribe in Queethluck. He says a gravel barge named Delta Chief, also belonging to Faulkner Walsh, sunk near his village 2 years ago and is a navigational hazard. He also says the barge, which contains heavy equipment and fuels, sits right above a popular source of drinking water.
Last December, when I went out and got my water from our communal watering hole, I was shocked to see a sheen of oil in the watering hole, and I told my boys, I don't think we're going to be getting our water from here anymore.
At the federal level, the Coast Guard gets involved when there's pollution or if the barge becomes a navigational obstruction. They can issue fines up to $40,000 per day, or three times the cost of cleaning up the mess. Coast Guard Petty Officer Patrick Brown says the law is intended to force responsible parties to clean up.
At the end of the day, our job is to ensure that the cleanup gets done. So if that means we compel the responsible party or the owner of the boat to do so, then that's what we'll do. If they are not available, we can't find them, or they just won't clean up, then we'll go ahead and do it ourselves.
DNR says they began to post trespass notices for 33 vessels in the Bethel area during their visit. Alaska DNR has never pursued a civil case or criminal charges for abandoned or derelict vessels obstructing navigable waters, according to officials. But they're considering it if Faulkner Walsh doesn't remove the problem vessels. Representatives from the company did not attend the public meeting, but did meet in private with DNR, DEC, and Coast Guard officials during their visit to Bethel. When asked during a phone interview how many vessels the company has in Steamboat Slough, Harry Faulkner, one of the owners, disputed DNR's count of around 10 vessels and had this to say.
I know what the count is. I own them.
Well, I just want to get the facts right. So you have how many barges?
I'm sorry, I got to take another call. I'll see you later.
The Coast Guard can, through a less lengthy administrative process, issue a notice of federal action, their first step toward fines they hope will compel Faulkner Walsh to clean up their vessels that are polluting. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The United States Special Representative for the Arctic is visiting Alaska. Retired Coast Guard Admiral Robert Papp is charged with managing the country's entire Arctic portfolio. That includes investigation of issues and potential claims to Arctic waters off Alaska's northern coastline. Admiral Papp spoke with KOAC's Dan Bross earlier today and said he's in Alaska to help determine the primary goals and challenges for the U.S. in the region.
For 4 years as Commandant of the Coast Guard, I was focused very narrowly and parochially on Coast Guard concerns. So now that I've taken on this new responsibility, I really need to open up the aperture and look a little more broadly at all the needs that are up here. So that's been part of the process. We're preparing at the State Department to take over the leadership of the Arctic Council beginning next spring. We'll have the chairmanship for 2 years. What cross-cutting policies, issues should the United States take up to press forward with during our chairmanship? And that's part of what I've been doing up here is we've been meeting with various constituency groups to try to determine what are those cross-cutting issues that are important across the spectrum of groups that we might take up to push forward.
Where are you going in Alaska and what have you heard so far?
Well, we started on Anchorage. We arrived Tuesday and started our meetings with various constituencies down there. We've been meeting with Alaska Native groups. We've been meeting with environmental groups, state legislature people. We held a public hearing yesterday down in Anchorage. Really a gratifying turnout. There was standing room only, which I think indicates the interest in Arctic issues and where the United States is going with it. We came up here to Fairbanks to talk to academia to see what the University of Alaska Fairbanks is doing in terms of Arctic research and what things might be important to the university. And from here, we go up to Barrow to talk to the North Slope people, the indigenous people, and find out what their concerns are and to stay in touch with them.
So what have you heard so far this week?
Well, each and every group has generally a laundry list of issues that they feel are very important to them. And most of those go back to resourcing. And the challenge for me is that the Arctic Council is not something that drives resourcing.
So when you say resourcing issues, what are you talking about?
Well, for instance, is almost every group that we talk to says we need the United States needs icebreakers. We need to build more. We need better communications. We need to put in fiber optic cable. We need better water quality and treatment. We need food sustainability. All these issues that really go back to how do you resource all that.
Admiral Papp, what things might be happening through Alaska or via Alaska institutions and individuals leading up to the U.S. chairing the Arctic Council?
that's what we're up here to inventory, and that's what we're doing and going around. I don't like to make excuses, but I've only been on the job for 3 weeks, and most of that has been consumed with learning the State Department, how to get business done in the State Department, and as I said, opening up the aperture for myself to the much broader issue of the Arctic as we go forward. So I'm doing a lot of listening while I'm up here, and fortunately, there are a lot of passionate people who are concerned about our Arctic, and are working on various projects and have interests and concerns, and we're going to evaluate all those as we go back to Washington and come up with those really key issues that we think should be advanced for the Arctic Council.
Robert Papp is U.S. Special Representative for the Arctic. He spoke with KUAC's Dan Bross earlier today. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska's militia movement works to show off a softer side.
We don't want to live in darkness and make people fear us. We want people to understand what we're about and support us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
The Republican candidates running for U.S. Senate said in a debate on Thursday they'll support whoever wins the GOP nomination. The big question was about Joe Miller, who had previously refused to say whether he'd run as a write-in or on a third-party ticket if he loses the Republican primary on August 19th. Now Miller says he'll back either Dan Sullivan or Mead Treadwell to help unseat the Democratic incumbent.
I believe I'm going to be the primary winner with the voters and God's help. But if it's one of you two guys, I never said this before, I'll support you guys. I will. We've got to get rid of baggage. There's no question about it.
The televised debate was hosted by Anchorage NBC affiliate station KTUU. In other Senate campaign news, former Alaska governor and TV personality Sarah Palin announced today she's endorsing Joe Miller. Most polls show Sullivan leading the Republican race and Miller running a distant third. Redistricting has thrown two incumbent Republicans from North Pole into the same state House district. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports on the unusual District 3 primary matchup.
Doug Isaacson and Tammy Wilson both often found themselves on the same side of an issue during the last legislative session, which was Isaacson's first and Wilson's second full term. Both oppose ballot Measure 1, which proposes to repeal oil company tax cuts. Both decry high energy prices, and both repeat the familiar refrain that the solution is to bring cheap natural gas into the interior. But after a few minutes of conversation, differences in style and substance emerge, like Isaacson's tendency to get wonky as he lists his priorities.
Energy, transportation, jobs, quality of life, investment here in Alaska by Alaskans, and I focus in on these in a structured manner that allows us to have progress.
Wilson sees herself as more of a retail politician, as she explained during a recent afternoon of door-to-door campaigning.
For me, it's all about the constituents. I mean, I'm out here walking the neighborhoods to give people the opportunity, whether they agree or disagree with me, to have that conversation.
Both talk of the need to cut state spending in the wake of falling revenues, but Wilson says that doesn't mean unemployment will increase.
Less government jobs, but maybe it means more private jobs.
But Isaacson worries that Alaska hasn't developed plans and policies to enable the private sector to offset shrinking state expenditures.
If we're going to have to reduce the budget, what are we doing to expand the economy? What are we doing to bring down the need for state intervention?
Their differences over the role of government takes an odd twist over one of the Fairbanks area's most divisive issues, improving air quality. Isaacson faults Wilson for claiming to support small government and local government. At the same time, she's leading ballot initiative campaigns to take control of air quality management from the borough and give it to the state.
I really stress keeping government close to the people. I don't believe that the state makes the better decision. I believe the state should be augmenting the municipalities. But Wilson says the state already has the resources and authority to deal with air quality problems, and she says creation of another local layer of government to do the same thing is unnecessary and wasteful.
Well, the state already has state law that already goes over air quality. We also have the resources on the state level to do that.
The winner of the Republican primary will go on to face North Pole Democrat Sharon Hunter in the November 4th general election. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
New Sea Alaska CEO Anthony Malott says part of the Juneau-based regional Native corporation's strategy for reversing recent losses will be to do business closer to home.
Very likely within the 6 months, you will see significant investments by Sea Alaska in Southeast or within industries that are heavily represented in Southeast Alaska.
Malott told the Juneau Chamber of Commerce on Thursday that Sea Alaska wants to provide economic opportunities and jobs for its nearly 22,000 shareholders. Most live in Southeast and the Pacific Northwest. The corporation has sold some of its business interests in areas like Florida, Mexico, and Alabama. Malott says it now has a $100 million investment fund and a $65 million fund for acquisitions.
So what we've done to transition is to load up effectively dry powder and bring on some people that know how to do mergers and acquisitions and know what we want to look like as a corporation 5-10 years from now and start making those acquisitions.
While jobs for shareholders will be important, Malott says the number one priority will be to invest in profitable enterprises. Malott took over as CEO at Sea Alaska's annual meeting in June.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable contributions. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Elizabeth Jenkins. This week on AK, a kinder, gentler militia. In 2011, members of the Alaska Peacemakers Militia were arrested for conspiracy to commit murder. The trial of their leader, Schaefer Cox, continually made headlines in the years that followed, most of them bad. Now other militia groups in the state are trying to show a different side to the movement. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez spent 3 days at a militia gathering in Sutton this summer and has this story.
Recording still, for sure?
Yep.
I want it to look tight. There's a reason you're in Ranger formation.
It's a picture-perfect day, and five people in camouflage are marching beneath a crag in the Talkeetna Mountains. Rifles are slung across their chests, and an aerial photography drone is hovering over. It almost looks like they're shooting an Army recruitment ad.
It's a nice shot of them going away right there.
Is it?
Yeah.
We'll probably use it.
But the people in camo aren't soldiers. They're members of the Anchorage Municipality Defense Force, one of the half dozen or so militias operating in Alaska. Their commander, Mikhail Insulaco, came up with the idea of using a drone to film part of the Alaska Militia Rendezvous, an annual training weekend that brings outfits from across the state together.
We're supposed to be paranoid about drones, but the reality of it is that, you know, this one's has a good purpose.
The only thing that Insulaco, or really any of the rendezvous attendees, seems paranoid about is seeming paranoid. The American militia movement isn't exactly viewed as cuddly. After a series of standoffs with federal agents in the 90s, militias got a lot of attention as a dangerous and fringe anti-government subculture. In Alaska, the Schaefer Cox incident didn't help that reputation. And taking in the scene at the militia rendezvous, it's easy to see how an outsider might be a little wary. The temporary compound is patrolled by armed men. There are pickup trucks draped in camo netting and plenty of dudes with beards and tattoos milling around. David Luntz is one of them.
You know, militias get a bad name.
Luntz commands the Central Alaska Militia, which covers a swath of land from Delta Junction to Fairbanks. For all that should make him intimidating, he's just, well, not. He's got an easy laugh, and if you talk to him for more than a couple minutes about how he leads the militia, the word transparency will inevitably come up.
We don't want to live in darkness and make people fear us. We want people to understand what we're about and support us. And these groups that, you know, hide and be all secret and they're not public and open, well, you know, people start fearing them.
So while it should go without saying that any motley crew can describe themselves as a militia, and Luntz obviously doesn't speak for all of them, the attitude he has is a common one for at least the groups attending the rendezvous. For Luntz, the militia is about a few things. He describes it as a community defense group, where the people involved learn solid survival skills. Outside of a couple of digs at the United Nations, there's not a lot of talk at the rendezvous about one world government or taking on the feds. You're more likely to hear about preparing for what some call general infrastructure failure and being ready for natural disasters and maybe alien or zombie attacks. Driving that home is one attendee's ammo dog who wanders the compound in a camouflage pack that reads Zombie Response Canine. That means, in addition to training on things like weapons transitions and close quarter tactics, there's also sessions on food storage and first aid.
I think a lot of people are apprehensive because they don't want to do that army training, but the militias and these groups that are formed have a lot of more positions that people could partake in that doesn't involve just running around in fatigues and army gear.
Luntz also gets a sense of camaraderie from his militia. He was in the army for 20 years, and now he does defense work for, yes, the federal government. As a member of the Constitution Party and a strong believer in the Second Amendment, Luntz also sees his involvement in the Central Alaska Militia as a basic exercise of his rights. But he doesn't see his militia as right-wing or even explicitly political.
You know, we don't not accept people because they're a liberal or they're, you know, whatever. And just as long as you support the Constitution and our form of government and our Republican setup, and, you know, then you're pretty much good. Just as long as you're not a felon and a sex offender.
Yep. The Central Alaska Militia runs background checks on potential members. And at the rendezvous, they also require attendees to have their pistols holstered and unloaded and prohibit anyone from handling a gun if they've had anything to drink within the past 8 hours. Luntz says they've given the state troopers their standard operating procedures, and they reach out to the boroughs, the state, the feds, whenever they hold an event on public land.
You know, it'd be kind of easy for somebody to be on the other side of this big compound here and out camping for the weekend, and they see us, and they're, oh my God, they have guns. And then they call the troopers, and there's a bunch of people out here with guns, you know. So, you know, we make those public contacts.
As it turned out, the troopers did get called to the area, but not because of the rendezvous. In fact, not a single shot was fired the whole weekend by the militia crowd. The troopers were there because a separate party sprouted up near the compound on the last night. There were drunk people driving four-wheelers, a couple of cases of indecent exposure, and shots being fired well into the AM. At breakfast the next day, there was some talk among the militia members about how rowdy the partygoers were and how they were glad the compound had a perimeter set up. From Sutton, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're heading to Healy, on the edge of Denali National Park in the Denali Borough.
I'm Clay Walker. I'm the Denali Borough Mayor. The Denali Borough is over 10,000 square miles. It's about the size of the state of Tennessee. And, you know, like Alaska as a whole, we're pretty lightly populated. We have a total of 1,800 people, and half the folks live in one town here in the county seat of Healy. which is a town of about 900 people. Big coal mine here, power generation here, and great mountains, wild spaces. Of course, the biggest mountain range of them all, arcing right through the borough, the heart of the Alaska Range. The resource and the coal here, it plays a big part in the history. And the rail line coming right through here was not so much to serve the great national park established in 1917, but essentially to bring the Healy coal to Fairbanks as they were running out of wood to burn. That rail line was the first transportation link, and essentially we started as kind of a rail town. The entrance area of the park is, it's not too far from Healy, so Healy is definitely influenced by the incredible seasonal influx of not only visitors but also employees. So, yeah, our population grows dramatically in the summer. We celebrate winter in late February in the park and here in Healy, and called Denali Winterfest. And, you know, we enjoy just a lot of those good winter activities, from snow machining to dog mushing to skiing, and also more family time in the winter for us. Finding your own adventures, there's plenty of it. And really, the closeness of the communities is something we all cherish and love about living here.
Clay Walker is the mayor of the Denali Borough. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Alexandra Gutierrez, Sarah Bernard, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Bethel, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Where can you see more than 1,000 entertainers, from Alaska Native dancers to dinosaurs? The Alaska State Fair. This year, everyone attending the fair can enjoy music free with fair admission, like Riders in the Sky, Young Dubliners, Redhead Express, Savannah Jack, Home Free, and Kentucky Lineman. Learn more at thealaskastatefair.org. Music, fair food, and good time fun. It's what the Alaska State Fair is all about. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.